when you combine message repeated over and over, often immune to the counterpoint, even the informed question, and you merge that with secrecy. This, of course, is a profound challenge to our concepts of informed consent.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Ron Suskind is perhaps America's leading journalist and author, writing about the current presidential administration. Ron Suskind is a graduate of the University of Virginia and of the Columbia University School of Journalism, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing when he was at the Wall Street Journal in 1995. His award-winning series of articles were enlarged into a book, A Hope in the Unseen, An American Odyssey from the Inner City to the Ivy League. Very touching book. In his recent work, Ron Suskind has demonstrated again and again that there is no substitute for well-informed inside sources. His 2004 book, The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House and the Education of Paul O'Neill, is a sweeping tour of the inner workings of the Bush presidency. His article just before the 2004 election, Call Without a Doubt, quoted one of the most inside players as saying that President Bush is animated by a sort of weird messianic idea of what he thinks God told him to do. In the 1% doctrine, deep inside America's pursuit of its enemies since 9/11, Suskind argued that Vice President Cheney has determined that, quote, suspicion, not evidence, is the new threshold for action against our enemies. Ron Suskind's latest book is The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism. In its review 2 weeks ago, the New York Times calls Suskind the rare writer who combines excellent reporting with a knack for journalistic writing about real people. Please welcome Ron Suskind.
George asked me, do I believe all that stuff? Of course not. I joke around and I say, yes, yes, but still a disappointment to his mother. She was hoping for law school. Even now she's hoping. You know, it's interesting to hear that procession of books, because I think readers, if my email queue is revealing in any way, are saying, you know, these books sort of move in a procession and progression, which I hadn't really thought about. And I say, well, that's maybe a good thing, because the only thing that ties these books together, of course, is the writer, me. I'm doing all of them at different stages of a kind of journey, a kind of investigation, I think, as to the known and knowable in this often increasingly evidence-free, though information-saturated era. This book, The Way of the World, actually carries echoes and imputations which are somehow similar to that first book, A Hope in the Unseen, where I follow an inner-city African-American male from the worst high school in America to Brown University. What that is on the fault line issues of race, which, of course, we say is, you know, original sin without solution, certainly in our lifetime. It's an attempt to find a shared national narrative by focusing on the protagonist, the other, the stranger, in this case, the inner-city black male, leaving the other America to find a home in the wider country. That's the whole concept. It's an American Hearts and Minds book, even though I wasn't using that term in those days. The books that follow, the now 3 books in 5 years on this extraordinary period following 9/11, also are moving in a kind of arc. Certainly The Price of Loyalty was very much a battle to really crack a kind of dome of silence and secrecy. You know, we're in a tough spot here because a message which has grown mightily over the last couple of decades, it now trumps even presidential power. presidents are criticized for being off message. I'm like, where does message come from? Who did the message part? You know, well, he's off message, and that's got to be somehow a fault or a sin. You know, and the notion of how to use the environment, of sort of, you know, constant sort of noise and image to tactical effect, good effect, if you're believing that power should be preserved and expanded, is an amazing battle. We can't even get our arms around it yet, several decades along. But when you combine message repeated over and over, often immune to the counterpoint, even the informed question, and you merge that with secrecy, you know, secrecy justified in all sorts of ways that are tough to challenge, in almost a kind of, you know, paternalistic, we know better what you need to know, so please just sit down and be quiet. You know, so we're going to classify everything down to the lunch menu, you know, even the lunch menu, you know, and you just have to trust us. We've got it under control. This, of course, is a profound challenge to our concepts of informed consent. I mean, essentially, the notion is consent will be informed by what we decide you ought to know. These two things together create an enormous challenge, which we're all still wrestling with. The last two books, in a way, were a kind of counterpoint to that. Not just The Price of Loyalty, where we do crack the dome. You know, Paul O'Neill, as the Treasury Secretary, is the protagonist. Obviously, it's about the Bush administration, the conduct and character of this president at this time. It could have been many presidents. I don't think it's an issue, frankly, of party. It's an issue of a kind of improvisational urgency that grips everyone and the things that they do. And is it right? Is it working? The next book, if The Price of Loyalty is about the process of self-governance being busted, the next book, The 1% Doctrine, is about that being the case. What happens at this time of peril? I wrote both books and suffered the ire of the administration. A friend of mine, a fellow journalist, said to me, he says, you know, Ron, it's important always to pick the right friends. But at certain points, it's also important to pick the right enemies. I think he said this to encourage me. You know, it's interesting because I know there were conversations inside of the Big White Building at certain points along the way, even after that New York Times piece, is when we go after Ron personally, do we just sell more of his books? And is that something we want to do? But sometimes they just can't help themselves. And you know, when we end The 1% Doctrine with a phrase which leads us to this current book, and it's something that I don't generally do, which is, you know, to pontificate a little bit. I'm really a reporter at heart, and I need my subjects. You know, I speak only in a way to frame them so that they can speak with a kind of clarity that is true to who they are in the times in which they live. But I picked up an old phrase from, of all places, Deuteronomy 16:20. You know, I stole it from my rabbi. He's one of my sources. He's like, oh, Ron, there's a great one. You know Deuteronomy 16:20? I'm like, no, I'm not much on all that. Well, this is lovely. And it's in Hebrew, which I'm not particularly well versed in. It's tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. All right, I may be pronouncing that last part a little off, but it's pretty close. Tzedek is the word for justice in Hebrew. And so the phrase is, justice, justice, this you must pursue. It's lovely. It's very old. It's been around a long time, ancient wisdom. And then I did a little research as to why justice is mentioned twice. Actually, I had a conversation with a prominent neocon about this, who is a person who's also, I'm Jewish, he's Jewish too. But he, you know, prides himself on his biblical acuity and scholarship. And I said, well, why do you think justice is mentioned twice? He said, well, because justice is such an important concept. It's mentioned twice for added emphasis. I'm like, actually, no. I said, the Hebrew scholars agree, and they agree on very little, if I may be so bold. They agree that justice is mentioned twice, once for the ends and once for the means. About the time this neocon and I were having this conversation, and he's an Iraq War prominent player, he was actually on the phone attempting to mislead the American public at that very minute, I believe. It was certainly what was in my pad. But that's the starting point of this book. What does that mean, really? What does it mean for these times? We've always had a battle between those two sort of hobgoblins, those gremlins, ends and means. They're always in tension. There's certain things that are so important that sometimes we'll say to ourselves, by any means necessary. Well, what is the potential pitfalls of that? So off we go. This book actually starts with some harrowing twists and turns. A big part of it deals with the existential threat we are actually facing at this point. And it's part of the miracle of this lovely, extraordinary information age in which we live, you know, where individuals can now tap extraordinary knowledge and also a knowledge that creates action. You know, every dusty village is now hooked up with internet and cable. It wasn't that way 30 years ago. And it has been an amazing sort of revolutionary shift in what people around the world can not only see, but do. Part of it is see. You know, I admire Tom Friedman, but I'm not that big on the notion that the world is actually flat. It feels that way sometimes because we're all drinking deep, all of us, of this sort of viscous stew of word and image and invidious comparisons as to whether you happen to be on the peak or in the valley, because the world is full of peaks and valleys. We happen to be in a peak. Much of the world, half of which lives on $2 a day or less, is in the valley. But they are energized. They can almost see the world more clearly and even us more clearly than they ever have before. And they're itchy. And they're saying, okay, all right, I'm seeing it now. And so now each of you has a house bigger than anyone in my village and cars. And, you know, I don't know, but my kid died last year from stuff you can get at the corner drugstore. So I'm having trouble hearing you when you tell me how I ought to be. I'm looking for something like humility or something. I'm not sure what. But this conversation's not working for me. Because, you see, I actually want my child's life to be better than mine. Isn't that something you all get, too? And it's not getting better quickly, and I'm impatient. And these days, we're also arming ourselves. We can do that too. And maybe even embracing ideologies that say this whole idea of individualism, of pursuit of happiness, of material gain and freedoms, well, I'm checking out. It's just, I'm not seeing anything that's working here in my part of the world. That's a real challenge for us, real challenge. You got to see them, got to know them. You've got to give up your knowingness. Why? Because this miraculous age of possibility, of information with democratizing power has meant that an angry cousin has shown up at the party, destructive capability, where small groups of people can now harness the destructive power once reserved for nations. Good God. What would Metternich or Talleyrand or Kennan say about this? How do you even begin with that? These non-state actors, you know, in an increasingly borderless world where you can buy anything with a click and a download and the manual comes with it. All right, how do we engage here in a way that's going to start working? So I start this book with a little bit of shock and awe with a senior official in the government who I've known for quite a while. He actually made a little cameo in the 1% Doctrine. His name's Rolf Moat Larsen. It's a bit of a funny name, but, you know, just call him Rolf. He's quite a guy. And he's really the key guy since 9/11, first at CIA most of the years, and recently at the Department of Energy, whose job it is to essentially deal with WMD, weapons of mass destruction, terrorism. This sort of Promethean nightmare combination. That's Rolf's job. He's very good at it, best we got. He's also a bumptious, headstrong, headlong character. He's been knocking doors down for years. You don't find that many like him in the government. He basically runs a model saying, at 5 o'clock today, I may be fired, and that's just fine with me. That's his definition of public service. He's having trouble when we start hanging around in 2006 because he is recognizing that the black markets around the world are full of activity, uranium black markets, or even black markets for plutonium. You know, there's a lot of nuclear power plants around the world. You can reprocess the plutonium into something that explodes. The uranium, that's a whole nother thing. And Rolf realizes that we're blind in these markets. The United States and its diminished sort of status and capacities around the world are such that we're not getting intelligence, human intelligence, the good stuff as to what's happening, and we're blind. And he's terrified. He's either the most important guy in the government or he's Chicken Little. He's not sure which. So we follow him. You know, something happened early on in this project. My wife said to me, she's like, you know, this is all these four books being one book idea. She's like, you know, that first book you did, Hope in the Unseen, you know, that was this was a brutal race. I mean, my God, an unsolvable American dilemma. But, you know, you went into a searing journey into the shadow valley, but you ended up being hopeful at the end. Don't write another book that breaks people's hearts. This is very good advice from my wife. It's like the thing you do best when you are at your best is that you look at very hard things, but you manage with the evidence to find your way to sunlight and you earn it. It might be nice to try that this time. So I start branching out. Rolf has this idea as that one part. He's going to send teams out into the world, undercover teams suited up just like terrorist groups from the United States, of course, to get into the uranium markets and buy the uranium. See where it is. See what it costs. See who's there. He calls this the Armageddon test. Will we pass it or not? Are we ready to handle the truth? And then, once they make their purchase, they're going to smuggle it back into the United States to show precisely how porous our borders really are. He calls this a shock the beast model, the beast being the United States government, of which he is a member. They pay his health plan. I mean, you know, it's an amazingly audacious concept. He tries, he does his best, and he moves forward. Now, meanwhile, I'm saying, ends and means. Tzedek. If we buy this idea, is there anything hopeful? If we get that balance right, can we figure out a way to get across the divides? Can we? Are the gaps, the fissures, the chasms too vast? And so we have other characters who arrive, including a kid from Pakistan, Usman Khosa, an amazing kid, an American dreamer. You know, and they're all moving side by side, he and Rolf and the president and the vice president. You know, they're going essentially in a kind of simultaneity, because that's the way the world actually works. It's also the way Dickens did it. You know, a complicated time and Victorian England, 19th century. You know, I don't know, it's too big. Let's get everyone in the room at the same time, narratively. So we weave between them in the book. Just like, I don't know, one of those movies that actually are not getting big box office, but I like them anyway. Usman comes to America. He's a star, the pride of Pakistan. He's got extraordinary and traditional American hopes. He ends up being an economic consultant in Washington. He's walking to the White House one day. He loves to walk toward the White House. He works in a building just a block away, a star at his office. And he's got on his gym shorts and his iPod, because he keeps his suits at the office. And he's walking in front of the big wrought iron gates, and he's fooling with the iPod. I mean, he's the wrong nationality to do that. And he's identified. And soon enough, he's dragged into an interrogation room under the White House. There's one under the lawn on the West Gate. He goes through a day of hell. Meanwhile, you see George Bush just above him, speaking just a few feet away about American virtue, about the choices we've had to make, while Usman is feeling his dreams tested. That's the opening scene of the book. And off we go. You know, there's a character, another one who weaves now in, a kid from Afghanistan named Ibrahim Frotan. Along with the many American characters are people coming here, because that's part of what it's all about, the global hearts and minds conversation. He's a kid from Bamiyan, where the Buddha statues were blown up. Kind of a rural, traditionally religious part of Afghanistan. And he's here in an amazing experiment where a high school kid from Afghanistan spends a year in an American high school and then is sent home. This is like something out of a reality show. Ibrahim actually is an admirer of America. And this is part of what you learn as a reporter. Just ride the beast wherever it goes. Give up your judgments. Whatever it is, it is. I say, why is it that you feel so strongly about America, Ibrahim? Well, it's a single thing. It was a movie. I said, a movie? Yes, yes. After things were awful in my little town, and then we got a generator, the first movie I saw was Rambo First Blood Part 3. First Blood? What, Stallone? Yeah, oh yeah. That's where he comes and saves Afghanistan. Remember that one? I didn't see that one. That was it. Yes, I felt very good about the American people then. I wanted to come to America. Okay. Whatever works, works. He spends a year in America, and it's hard. The cultural collisions are just dizzying. Here, he's never engaged with a young lady, though he's 17. He's never even seen one who's not covered, for the most part. Now he's in a U.S. high school in Denver, in a kind of a leafy, tony Denver suburb. And he's like in a, poor kid, he's like in a testosterone frenzy. Because he's frozen. He goes back to his movies, because, you know, they'll help him. You know, when he tries to engage, it doesn't work. You know, and he washes out of Denver, even though the people in Denver do everything, the family he's with, and he's hanging by a thread. They're ready to send him back to Afghanistan. Can we manage to figure it out, to understand the shared human narrative? Here's an experiment. How's it going? Well, not well. He almost gets washed out. They can't send him back. There'll be political problems with that. So they send him to Keene, Pennsylvania. Anyone here been to Keene, Pennsylvania, near Lake Erie? Yeah, I didn't think so. You're just not the kind of Keene crowd. It's a depressed area, Rust Belt, double-digit unemployment, gritty. Ibrahim ends up in this high school. He's lost. He's wandering the halls. He's spotted by a girl. He's a handsome kid. It's nice, helpful. And she's actually someone who's used to taking in strays. You know, to make ends meet in Kane, lots of women, single mothers and others, bring in foster kids. And she had about 20 in her house as a girl. They kept coming and going, foster kids. And she knows that look of someone who's a little lost. So she goes up to Ibrahim and says, you know, we're gonna be friends. We are. It's like, really? She's a beautiful girl. They essentially become a couple. You know, not much physical, but a lot of emotional exchanges. Emails, long conversations every night. And then the key moment arrives, a month along, where there's a little party for Ibrahim at his host family's house. You know, he's got his host mom, he calls her. And then she's a woman, she's a French teacher in a mill town, which I think tells you all you need to know. And they have a little party for him. And he says, well, I have one friend. And Jillian, the girl, comes. And they sit on the couch. And Ibrahim is giddy at this celebration. And she says, Ibrahim, actually, can I show you something? And she pulls out a picture. And it's a picture of she with a baby. And he's like, well, who's that? She says, that's my daughter. Looks at the baby, looks at her, the picture at her. So, oh, your daughter. She said, I didn't want other people to tell you. So I thought I'd tell you myself. She had a baby out of wedlock as a 10th grader. So then we have it. Worlds colliding. Everyone leaves. Ibrahim goes to his host mom. She's doing the dishes. He's like, we need to talk. Yeah. I think Jillian is married. And Mary Lisa, the host mom, says, well, I don't know, what do you mean married? Well, she's got a baby. Oh, right, that's the girl. Clicks for her. Ibrahim, sit down. Wipes her hands in the dish towel. The father her husband. They're not married. Do you have any experience with that sort of thing in Afghanistan? Ibrahim says, uh-huh. We would have to kill her and the baby. And then the room gets very quiet. And Mary Lisa, the French teacher in the mill town, says, well, you see, you're an American now, Ibrahim. So the question is, but what do you think? That's the American question. A belief that what Ibrahim thinks actually does matter. What you think actually matters here. And he sits for about 2 minutes, doesn't say a thing. As the water drips in the sink and the clock ticks, and then he turns to her and says, you know, but she's my friend. And a month later, he takes her to the senior prom. The Muslim boy from Bamiyan and the bad girl from Kane. And good God, how they dance that night. Now, for anyone who wonders if human ingenuity is up to this extraordinary Promethean challenge we face, if we can find the shared human narrative in time before some next attack where we slip into our dark impulse of fear and protection, if the United States, now suffering as it is from diminished moral authority, wonders, how do we get that back? What's George Marshall doing in that plan of his? How does that work? Now, certainly they had needs, but it was about doing the right thing and not asking anything in return. Wasn't that the idea? And people end up saying, oh, that means you think we're peers, yes, and we're equals, and you actually believe in free will. And you say that, well, I have a chance to decide whether if or when I'll bend toward the sunlight, right? That's right. It's a different model. These are all the issues that now, beneath the noisy, fractious, partisan nightmare we're living, are really the American virtues that often save us. Jillian and Ibrahim kind of know it. Usman spends 2 years trying to reimagine himself in America after his nightmare in the interrogation room under the White House. He kind of manages it at the end. Not easy. You know, I'll just finish with this, and then we'll open it up for questions. You know, there are news cycle driving disclosures in this book that have roiled the global news cycles about things that we've done. You know, the Iraq intelligence chief, us meeting with him early, that never being revealed to the American public, well before the war. What do we know about WMD? You know, this moment where the president and his team thinks about whether this London liquid bomber plot, the biggest plot since 9/11, is something we should wait to run its course, or wouldn't it be nice if we had a deliverable for those midterm elections in 2006? And make no mistake, that's the discussion. All of those things that you say, good God, I hope that's not the case, but it is. Well, all of those harrowing disclosures, in a way, are the starting point of this book. Because the book's about how we're responding to hold tight, each of us, to our own moral compass. Hey, I've got one of those. I use it in my own life. And to repair one's moral authority for an individual and for a nation are not all that different. How do we get that back? Because that's the source of true power that can and has in the past transformed the world, often surprisingly. You know, the 9/11 Commission, in what I thought was an eminently worthwhile endeavor, you know, Philip Zelikow, one of your guys here, was in the center of that. He's a guy I know, buddy. You know, they tried to figure out what went wrong there. And they came up with a phrase, which is really their signature phrase, that it was a failure of imagination that left us vulnerable. A failure to imagine, ostensibly, the ingenuity and malevolence of our enemies in a way that we might have protected ourselves. Now, you know, 7 years later, I think actually it is a failure of imagination of a different kind. A failure to imagine who we might yet become as a nation and how we might yet lead the world. That imagination is the ones that our enemies are desperately opposed to. They're working furiously to keep us locked in fear, in revenge, in recrimination, in us-them conflict, us versus them, not we, not just here in America, but across those borders that mean less and less. So the question that the book ends with is, how do we restore that imagination and that moral authority? Which really ends up being, I think, the key to the next century and who will be victorious, if you will, in being the seminal agent, which nation, which people. You know, the challenge of some of our opponents is extremely evolved. Bin Laden, Zawahiri, the millionaire heir of the Saudi royalty, the pediatrician, you know, they're actually in the Arab world, they're guys on the peak. They walked into the valley, they live in a cave. On day one, they win most of the arguments. with the vast populations of the world who live on next to nothing. Know thine enemy. Figure out what to say back that works and what to do that will last. That's our challenge. This country is about the valley rising, right? That's the miracle of this place. People coming here in rags, inventing and reinventing themselves and renewing this nation over and over. Right now, there's a world living in the valley who sees us now more clearly than ever and says, are you going to be true to these oaths that we've heard so much about? Can you teach us how to sing a song like yours? It'll be our version, not yours, ours. But at least one about the valley rising. Because I don't want to live all of my life in the valley. I want to get the sunlight too. And so that's the way I met my wife's challenge for this book, which is to try to earn some hope. Thanks for listening.
Let me suggest that with the proper question, maybe we can get Ron Suskind to show a little emotion, a little passion. Ron, could you, while I'm moving to the back of the room, could you talk to us for a minute about the craft of the writer who writes books like this, where you're so dependent on sources who do not want to be disclosed?
And sure.
How do you deal with what you know will be the inevitable nitpicking?
Yeah. Can people hear this? Does this work? Okay. That's a good question, George. Let me say that I actually have a rule that I started to use in The Hope and the Unseen that I use for everything since. And it's what I call my good enough reasons rule. Some of you may have heard me do a little riff on this before, but it's simply this. I spent in the early 90s, mid 90s, a lot of time with gang leaders in urban America and other kids like Cedric Jennings. And what was interesting is that they were saying things to me that me and my knowingness, my certainty with all my graduate degrees and whatnot, I'm like, oh, they don't understand, those poor young people. They said pants were important, like those baggy ones, and sneakers. I'm like, no, they don't matter. Graduate school matters. That's what matters. No, wrong. Mm-mm. Give up your knowingness, your omniscience, your certainty. It's about them. It's about their good enough reasons. And that's where the rule comes from. People do what they do for good enough reasons. Good enough that intent flows to action, the thing you can see. They may not be your reasons or mine, but they're good enough. Know those good enough reasons. You can know a person almost as well as you can know another. And along the way, hour after hour, week after week, when you're with them, they end up in a place that's beyond easy judgment. Even some people who've done some pretty tough things. Because at some point they're like, you really want to know why I did this? I said, yes. Okay. You're going to be careful with what I tell you. I said, that's all I want to know. Your good enough reasons. And it creates a kind of truth therapy. And I am untrained, obviously, as a psychologist. But we engage in a kind of colloquy. And all the sources are in the good enough reasons camp. Whether they're senior White House officials or Usman Khosa interrogated under the White House. Now, what's interesting is that when we go through this process, and the sources in this book, there are several layers, especially on the most, contentious and in this political era, tendentious disclosures of non-public information. I have many off-the-record sources. In this case, instead of relying on only them and saying, I met them in the parking garage and you'll never know who they are, and you won't, I said there are some people who are not the original sources.
They know it, and I will say as much in the book. They are actors. So I will go to them, and I'll lay out the story. And they'll go, which they did, how do you know it all already? I'm like, I do. And you're not the source. Oh, okay, what do you want me to do? I said, well, tell me what people felt, what it meant, what was the context, what you did on that day, and how you felt based on your good enough reasons. Several of the name sources who are quoted in full, long, and vivid quotes are in that category. Now, my idea in conversations with many of them is that they would not be targets. And I was wrong about that. They were. Many of them said, I'm ready to be a target. I'm ready. I'm ready to step up and speak truth to power. These times demand it. We need to right and redirect the ship of state, and I'm ready to take the hit if need be. Some did, some buckled. I've done this for many years. You know, Paul O'Neill, The Price of Loyalty, same conversation as the sources here and in 1% Doctrine. O'Neill said something to me, which I thought, you know, actually was half a joke, and the half that's not was actually quite sensible. He says, look, I'm an old guy, and I'm really rich. He's the chairman of Alcoa. So Ron, there's nothing they can do to hurt me. Well, very few people are in that position. And even now, even though some of the sources, one really, just kind of buckled, and there were a lot of non-denials that were sent out. And interesting, congressional investigators, because as you know, there's parts of the book that are now the subject of two congressional investigations, one in the Senate, one in the House. They actually chat with me from time to time. We keep a bit of an arm's length relationship because they have to do their investigation, and I've written my book, they can read it. But, you know, they said to me, one of them said, I don't understand why people were so convinced by these sort of non-denials that the administration put out about this one part of illegality. It's clear they're non-denial denials. They're these legalistic things that the lawyers all do together. But no one seems to understand that. We did during Nixon. One of them's an old guy, been around for decades. You know, during Nixon, we knew not to put any credence in that. But now it's a little different. There's a lot of scandal fatigue. So some of those disclosures, I know some of you have been following, are saying, why not more pickup? Why not impeachment hearings? You know, it takes a while. You know, the Joe Wilson-Vowery Plame thing took a special prosecutor in a good long span of time. You know, this is an area of illegality, violation of the National Security Act. We can get into specifics. I think most people already know about this letter from the Iraq intelligence chief, and it's a fabricated thing. And then the sources say it came from the White House and then was executed, actually just as ordered, and it popped up and said there were no WMD and Muhammad Atta trained in Iraq before 9/11. It was sort of a solve all the problems in one letter thing, you know, like a fantasy letter. And it did pop up, and it roiled the global news cycles, and poor Tom Brokaw's there talking about it, you know, on the Meet the Press. You know, this is a lot of, it's amazing, a lot of. You know, that's illegal. You can't run disinformation campaigns on the American public as the U.S. government. That's illegal. You know, I don't know how it'll turn out. That's one of the things that one of the sources got whacked with. You know, but in fact, what's interesting is that pretty much all these sources have held pretty firm. And there's something about that nice, full, paragraph-long, on-the-record quote that just, you know, you can't really budget. It just locks right into the soil. And that's why you do it. Ultimately, I'm in touch with virtually all of them. And all the sources for all the books, you know, I'm still in touch with them. I've been talking to Paul O'Neill a lot lately. You know, he's very agitated by what's happening. So that's part of the answer to that source question. But let's get some other questions.
If I read...
Hi.
Hiya.
I thought it was like the voice of God there. Where was that coming from?
Not yet. That's the second... That's the second question. The first question is easier. If I read your Esquire article last week, do I still have to read the book to pass the course?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. That, well, look, that Esquire piece about what we learned from Bush is still a bit of historical record writing, I think. And the whole purpose of this book was to move past this troubled period into something that feels like forward motion. Take a second. Okay.
I'd like you to go back into the Old Testament for a minute.
Yeah.
Put on your yarmulke.
Mm.
Tell me.
I'm just glad that God is here to help me with all of that. Thank you for being here.
If you could channel one of the Old Testament prophets, can you predict if any of the present administration is going to be indicted for any of the crimes?
Oh, boy. So who do I go with? Jeremiah, Ezekiel? Who's going to be the prosecutor on that? There is some talk. Joe Biden actually was speaking a few weeks ago, right after Way of the World came out, and everyone was jumping up and down about how do you move forward and do you prosecute and all that, saying that if he and Obama win, that they will say rule of law is not something with a time frame on it, and they will move forcefully into finding out what is true, what is the evidence, and moving in a legal way. I'm not sure whether they will do that or not. I think a lot of it has to do with a sense of what political will is at various times. I think that, frankly, is wrong. I think the whole idea of the Constitution as an active living document is it should not be subject or captive to those issues of what the political winds may or may not say. But that's sort of what's happening on that front.
Yes. Do you have any thoughts as to how President Bush might use the pardon power as he leaves office?
Well, I'm not sure if he can pardon himself, but I think someone has to do that. Maybe if he made Cheney the president. Well, there was a lot of pardoning that went on at the end of the Clinton presidency. And there may be some pardoning that goes on at the end of this one. I'll tell you, and we'll finish up here and we'll do some books here in a second. But, this period is coming to a close, this era. There's another one that's already unfolding. You can feel it, can't you? I think, frankly, we're going to be arguing about Bush and Cheney for the next 30 years like we did about Nixon. It's at least my hunch, which actually might help with some sales of the paperbacks. But the fact is that part of what's happening, which I feel very, very guardedly hopeful about, is that the self-correcting processes of this democracy, which are really the key features of it, that it can correct itself. That's the brilliance of it, really. Well, they have been undermined, often with strategic kind of clarity over the past some years. Whether it's the free press, again, it's executive power that the founders were most fearful of. A free press, judicial oversight, congressional oversight. Well, the other team said, well, hold on a second. They have these sort of self-correcting machines. Let's throw some sand in the gears, and they won't work. And then we're free, and we can move forward to do what's needed, when needed, at a time of peril. And once it all works out, no one will fault us. It's a little like an Enron model. Well, those self-correcting processes are kind of kicking up now. They're spitting the sand out of the gears. And I think that people are seeing that and saying, okay, so how does this work? What makes this country different? What are the American values? And I don't use values as a lot of people do in the values debate. I say there are actually shared values. And when American values work best, it's when they attach most closely to wider human values. Those are the ones that really work. It's not something special to us, it's just we figured it out. The bigger pageant of humanity, that's what the founders figured.
when I just passed, you know, Madison's house as I'm driving down. And I'll just finish by saying the thing I learned here at UVA from great smart professors who really told me, okay, Ron, being clever was enough in high school. If it's going to work here, you need to learn how to be authentic. I'm like, oh, God, that takes so much work. Yes, yes. And they gave me Federalist 51, which is the great Madisonian offering. 10 and 51 are both pretty good ones if you want to pick two. But I like 51 especially, and I like the way Madison says, here's the way this system's going to work. Self-interest, everyone's got that. Let's be real and clear about that. What we're going to do is set up a government, and in a way a whole society, where self-interest will be made to counteract self-interest. All right? It will produce what de Tocqueville later calls the bourgeois virtues, which I kind of like that phrase. You know, it's not égalité and humanité. That was fine for the French. It's honesty, pride in what you do, a kind of probity, a sense that I'm going to be accountable here in my own pursuit of happiness journey. They're modest virtues, but they have great legs. And right now, over this period, self-interest has had a terrific couple decades. And I'm partially at fault as well. We all are. Now we're at a moment where people are going, we need to think about the ways self-interest, properly managed, creates that drop of nectar called shared interest. That's the stuff. You don't need that much of it, but you need it. It's what makes the whole thing work. And right now, I think we're in a struggle to figure out how to get to shared interest. And not just here anymore. Now we're in a conversation which is a self-interest versus self-interest conversation with so much of the world. Without easy rule of law. Without a notion that government, if it is sufficiently powerful and not one drop more, will create shared interest. That's Madison's idea. It will be the agent of the shared interest in the great conflicts of self-interest. It'll manage it like a referee, like somebody with real teeth. Well, now as we look around the planet, we see self-interest colliding in many ways that are actually probably nicely susceptible to some of these American ideas of how do you get just that one precious dollop of shared interest, not just here in America, but across the borders of a roiling planet, such that Rolf is not up at night anymore and saying, what does it look like when a catastrophe happens in Midtown Manhattan? Such that Ibrahim comes to America and says, this is where I will follow breathtaking dreams. Where people around the world go, right, that's the song. Ours is different here. We don't even use your words, but the tune is similar. And it means that my kid's life is going to be a little better. It means that I'm going to think clearly about myself as an actor. Somebody who frankly is of worth. That what I think does matter. Because it does. Thanks for coming tonight.